Okay, we're beginning here on the bottom of Pay Bet Amud Bet. The Gemara is discussing the additional items that the Gemara says that, well, are there no more gzeirot or takanot that we knew about? And then the Gemara spoke about the issues of Hurkunus and Aristoblus. And over there, they mentioned that they were gozer al chachma yivanit. And the Gemara now wants to question that inyan of the gzer of chachma yivanit, where it says, Uve chachma yivanit mi asira? Is it really true that learning this Greek knowledge, Greek philosophy, is problematic? Vatanya amarabi be'eretz Yisrael lashon sursi lama. When it comes to Eretz Yisrael, why do we speak this language sursi? O lashon hakodesh, o lashon yivanit. Better off to speak either Hebrew or Greek. Vamarabi yosi bavel lashon arami lama. Why do we speak aramit there? O lashon hakodesh, O lashon Parsi. Why don't we either speak Hebrew or speak Persian? So what it seems is that lashon sursi, which Tosfot tries to indicate here, is equivalent to Aramit. It is just a different dialect of Aramit, a less clear, a less pure dialect of Aramit, as he notes in his proofs that he brings. And he says that we have the same thing in our neighborhoods where people speak the same language, but they have different dialects. But more likely, it seems that Lashon Sursi has some sort of derivations from Syria and maybe the Greco-Syrians. But it was some sort of mix, it seems, between Hebrew and Greek. And Aramit, similarly, was some sort of mix between the Hebrew and the Babylonian and Persian languages at the time. But it seems to be that these were unique languages of the Jews of those locations, although there were variations of that dialect that were spoken by others. Because of that, both Rabbi over here and Rabbi Yossi in Bavel say, if you're going to speak a language, speak a pure or clear language. Speak either Hebrew or speak Greek. That's with regards to Eretz Yisrael, which is closer to Greece, also is more influenced by the Greeks. And for those in Bavel, who are under generally the Persian dominion, and that the language of the aristocracy was probably Persian, but that the Jews were not so familiar with, that we know already from the Gemara in Gittin, that many times it was written in Persian, or the aid was a Persian aid, that they did not understand each other's language. But in either case, Rabbi Yossi says in Bavel, that why are you speaking Aramit? Either speak Hebrew or speak Persian. Why are we speaking these, we call them pidgin languages, that are mixes between other languages and that are unique to the Jews? So Amrei, that the Gemara doesn't have such a big issue with, and says, Lashon Yivani Lachud, Chachma Yivanit Lachud. That there's a difference between speaking Greek and this Greek Chochma. Now, the Chochma Yivanit, as we're going to see in a second, is not necessarily, like we would think, more of the Greek philosophy or esoteric intellectual type of thinking, but rather it seems that the Chochma Yivanit was a method of communication or etiquette that was used by the upper class or aristocratic class, the political echelons. And so therefore, if you were amongst those individuals and communicated with those individuals, it was important to be familiar with it. Whereas if you were just a lay person, it was less meaningful to you. Now, in the story that was told before about Hurkunus Aristobulus, it seems that there was a Zaken Echad that was familiar with Chochma Yivanit. Seems to be that he was influenced by those political echelons or that Greek thinking that was a part of that aristocratic or political class. And so they were Oseret. And now the Gemara asks about the Chochma Yivanit mi asira. Was it really restricted? V'amar Rav Yehuda, amar Rav Shmuel, mishum Rav Shimon ben Gamliel. Eini olala lenafshi mikol benot iri. This is from Eicha. It says, there my eyes, whether it means that are filling my soul, or it means my eyes cried in my soul, mikol benot iri, for all the daughters or the children of my city. And now he explains the Midrash on that. Elef yiladim hayu bebeit abba. We had 1,000 children that were in our household or in our family. Chamesh meot mehem lamdu Torah. 500 of them were learning Torah, 500 of them were learning Chochma Yivanit. The only people, or only remnant of those individuals, Rabbi Shimon Gamliel being a part of the lineage of the Nasi, that he remains after the Churban HaBayit. I myself remain, Khan, Uben Achi Abba BaAsia, and my first cousin in Asia. So there are only two of us that remain. Now, it's clear here that they were learning Chochma Yivanit in the house of the Nasi. So Amrei Shaini Beit Rabban Gamliel Shekuvim the Malchut. That was an exception to the rule because they were involved in the political system and they needed to petition the government and were involved with issues between the Greeks or whether it was the Romans and the Jewish people. And therefore, they needed to be familiar with this Chochma Yivanit in order to interact and lobby on behalf of the Jews. And therefore, it was important that they knew that Chochma Yivanit, even though the Gzeirah itself was oseret for the general populace or for lay people. And as Tosfot says over here, that we're going to see in a second, that the Gzeirah, when it was put in place, had this exception built into it. It wasn't like they came up with the exception after the fact, but rather when the Gzeirah was put in place, there was an exception for those people that needed to be involved in political issues. Uchadetanyo, and we have a similar braita that tells us something that is asur. Hamasaper kume hare ze medarkei amori. Someone who gets a haircut in the komi manner, which is midarkei amori. Darkei amori usually means something that is done by the non-Jewish nations. Either something that's particularly associated with Avodah Zarah, or a practice that has no basis whatsoever. I mean, that there's no reason or logical basis for acting in this manner. For that reason, we've spoken about this in other contexts. This is not the main sugya of Darkei Amori, but, for instance, the Tshuva Tamarik speaks about the fact that doctors who wear a particular garb or judges who wear a particular garb, that's not necessarily something that is illogical. That's something that makes sense because it identifies the position or the profession of the individual. And so therefore, you may not call that Midarkei Amori. But over here, this Misaper Kumi, which is a particular haircut, was something that had no basis, no logic behind it. It was a way of associating with a certain class of individuals or identifying with a certain group of individuals. And therefore, it was midarchei amuri. And that is something that even might be asur midoraita. Midoraita, there's no definition of darchei amuri. So really, it's left up to the chachamim to determine. So the chachamim say that maseper kumi is clearly part of darchei amuri. Nevertheless, they made an exception to that rule for Avtumalos Bar Ruvain because he was petitioning or lobbying on behalf of the Jews with the government, and so he was allowed to get this haircut. Now, he tried to do that, or he dressed in that fashion in order not to be known as a Jew and be able to petition on behalf of the Jews, even though he was Jewish. What exactly this Komi haircut is unclear. It seems that it involves maybe two parts to it. One part is that the sides were cut straight across above the ears, meaning eliminating the peyote. And the second feature seems to be that they cut all the hair in the front or the top of the head, and then they would leave what's called a blurit in the back. They used to leave some sort of ponytail in the back. So that seems to be the nature of the haircut, that it involves cutting straight across on the sides and maybe something short in the front with longer hair in the back. But it's clearly a haircut that was associated with a certain class of individuals or the aristocracy in Rome or in Greece. And therefore, it would have been inappropriate for a Jew to have such a haircut. But this individual, Avtumalos Bar Ruvain, who had to deal with these government officials and therefore needed to look like them in the beginning, at least, he wanted to lobby on behalf of the Jews without them knowing he was Jewish. They permitted him to get this haircut so that he could fit in and that he could act on behalf of the Jews. And the same thing here, they let them speak. Here you see that Chochma Yivanit is not necessarily philosophy or some intellectual realm, but Saper means that they spoke. It was a language or a method of communication. Rashi in other places mentions that it was Derech Rimazim. It was a maybe even an etiquette where you would look in a certain way, wink in a certain way, do things that were indications of your positions on situations or negotiations. And therefore, it was important for Beit Rabban Gamliel to be familiar with that language or that method of communication because they were Krovim L'Malchut. they interacted with the government officials, and therefore it was important for them to be able to interact with them on a level playing field in order to negotiate on behalf of the Jews. Therefore, as Tosfot mentions over here, the Gzeirah or Takana, when it was put in place, had that exception built into it, both by Misaper Kumi and by the case here of Misaper Chochma Yivanit. It has this exception to the rule that those that were involved or necessitated their involvement with the government were allowed to, or given a dispensation with regards to these Takanot, or these Gzeirot, either to speak Chochma Yivanit or to dress in a manner that allowed them to participate in the political discussions. So then, Tanur Banan, Roigadel Adam et Kelev, and Mkein Kashur Bishal Shelet, Avel Megadelu Beir Asmuchal Asfar, Bekoshro Bayom, Matiro Balaylo. So here now we have a braita that says a person shouldn't bring up a dog in the house unless it's tied up, unless it's chained up. But if he lives in a city that is on the border, then he can bring up a dog. He must tie it during the day, and then he can release it at night, obviously for protection, because it is a border city. Tanyo, Rabbi Eliezer Agadol Omer, Hamigadel Klavim, Kimigadel Chazirim. Someone who brings up a dog is like someone who brings up a chazir, a pig. L'may nafkamino. What does it matter? What does it mean that if you bring up a dog, it's like bringing up a chazir? L'may nafkamino. What does that matter? Bringing up a dog is like bringing up a pig. Make a malei barur. That goes back to what we saw before with regards to bringing up pigs, that there was an arur ish shemigadel chazirim, someone who brings up pigs. So that arur that is associated with pigs, here Rabbi Lezer HaGadol associates it also with the klavim, with the dogs. Amar Rav Yosef Bar Menume, Amar Rav Nachon, Bavel ki iras mucha lasfar dami. The Jews living in Bavel have the same status as Jews living on the border in Eretz Yisrael. Now, the Gemara says, Targama Nardo. They explained that, or they defined that, qualified that to be Nardo. So it wasn't the entire Bavel. I mean, Jews who living in Bavel. Bavel is a large area, let's call it the country of Bavel. But they're specifically referring to the Jews of Nardo, who were faced, or really surrounded by non-Jewish cities. And therefore, Nardo felt itself on the border, quote-unquote, because it didn't feel safe because of all the non-Jewish cities that it surrounded, or that it was in some ways isolated from some of the other Jewish communities. And so because of that, Narda has the same status as a city on the border, and that people could keep dogs for protection. Darish Rav Dustai Demin Beri, Uvenucho Yomar, Shuva Hashem, Revivot Alfei Yisrael. This is written in Parshat Balotcha with regards to the Aron. Talking about Vayib and Saharon, the second pasuk is Uvenucho Yomar. When it rests, it says, Shuva Hashem, Hashem should return, Ishchina should be present, amongst the Rivavot, Alfei Yisrael. So Rivavah is 10,000. Rivavot in plural, the minimum of 10,000 in plural is 20,000. Alfei Yisrael is 1,000. The minimum of 1,000 in plural is 2,000. So that is 22,000 of Yisrael. So the Gemara here, and in other places in Chas, is Doresh, that a minimum of 22,000 Jews is needed in order for to have the Hashra'at HaShchinah. Now, as Tosfot points out, we have a Mishnah and Avot that we learn and we've seen in other places that Hashra'at HaShchinah does not require 22,000. First of all, for a minyan, 10 people, when we get together, we assume that there's some sort of Hashra'at HaShchinah that's involved there. So Tosfot differentiates and says that, yes, that is true, b'chol be'asara, but here we're talking about Nevi'im and the Mishkan. So we were talking about more an obvious manifestation of the Shekhinah, it requires 22,000 Jews for that type of Hashrat HaShekhinah. When I'm at Hashrat HaShekhinah for 10 people or for the other numbers that are mentioned in the Mishnayot and Avot, there we're talking about Benistar, the Hashrat HaShekhinah. But if you want explicit, obvious Hashrat HaShekhinah, that involves a minimum of 22,000 people. And that is associated like with the Mishkan or with the possibility of Nevuah or Nevi'im coming to Bnei Yisrael. Now there was, as you can see in Tosfot, an alternative girsa, Velo Garsina Shnei Alafim Rivavot, 2,000, 10,000s, because that would then far exceed the number of Jews that there were in the Midbar, as Tosfot points out, and therefore it would seem unlikely or unseemly that that was the number that they were speaking about. There are those that try to defend the number based on the fact that the 600,000 people that we have in the Midbar are only the males from 20 to 60, and therefore there could have been a larger number of Jews that were there in the Midbar. But leaving that aside, the Gemara assumes here that 22,000 is the minimum needed for Ashrat HaShchinah. Lamed Chashin Shchinah Shorah L'Yisrael Pachot Mishneh Lafim Mishneh Revavot, based on what we said before, a minimum of 1,000, a minimum of 10,000, in the plural form is 2,000 and 22,000. So now, Chaser Achat, if you have 22,000 minus 1, Vayitah Yisham Meuberet, and you have a woman who is pregnant, Benehem, amongst them, Ruyah Lashlim, and when she gives birth, now we're going to have 22,000, she can have Shorah HaShchinah. And then a dog barks at her, and she miscarries because of that dog that scares her. That person causes the Shekhinah to leave Klal Yisrael because that 22,000th individual was never born because of what the dog did. But here it's reinforcing what we saw in the Mishnah already, that the danger of having the dog is the damage that it can cause, not only from the biting, but also from the terror that it causes in people through its barking and through its scare tactics. And so for that reason, we don't want the dogs there because of the damage that they can cause to other individuals, and including here what the Gemara puts together, a situation or scenario where the results of the dog's barking that causes a miscarriage are dramatic. Not only do we have a loss of life, but we also have the loss of the possibility of Ashrat HaShchinah. There was this woman who went up to this house to bake. Remember, we've seen this in the Gemara a number of times, that people used to rent from other individuals their ovens, their baking areas, in order to bake their bread. Navach bakalba, seems like the owner's dog barked at her. Amarla mare, lo tistafe mine, don't worry, don't be afraid of this dog. Shkule nibe, his teeth were removed. Rashi over here brings lishna achrina, Arba Shinei Akelev Harukot, which are the four incisors of the dog, those were taken out. Amrle Shkila Tivutech, take your goodness, Bishadya Chizrei, throw it on the thorn bushes, Kvarna Vlad. The fetus has already moved. Meaning that telling me this after the fact isn't going to do anything. The dog's barking already scared me sufficiently that I'm going to miscarry this child already. And therefore telling me after the fact that the dog's not dangerous or that it doesn't have teeth is not going to help the situation at this point. But here again, reinforcing this idea that the dog scaring the individual is as big a problem as the dog's actual damage, which it can do by its biting. Right now, the last thing that was mentioned in the Mishnah is Ein Porsin Nishvin Lyonim, that we don't put out traps for the doves. And the Mishnah says that the range that they have is 30 ris. The Gemara says, do they really travel 30 ris, which Rashi noted in the Mishnah is 4 mil. So if you just want to do some translation, a 4 mil to 30 ris means it's a 7.5 multiple. So if you do that, each mil is 2,000 amot. So that means that every ris is 2,000 amot divided by 7.5, which is 266 and 2/3. So that's the distance of a ris, is 266 and 2/3 amot. So if you multiply that by 7.5, that's where you get the amount of 4 mil, or the 30 ris that we're speaking about here. So that distance, the Gemara says, sounds very far for the doves to travel. But it's not, because they have a Mishnah. Marchikin et ha-shovach min ha-ir chamishim amah. You have to put a shovach, a dove coat, at least 50 amot away from the city. Now, it seems that the placement of it at least 50 amot away from the city is to protect the fields of the city or the gardens of the city so that those birds don't feed off of the items that are planted by the people of the city. So you have to put it sufficient distance away from the city so that the birds aren't eating what otherwise is the grains and the vegetation that the individuals of the city are planting for their own usage. But that seems like 50 amot would be sufficient, not the 30 ris or 4 mil that we're talking about, which is a significant large distance, and would indicate that the doves would fly back to the city even if they were more than 50 amot out. So I'm Rabbi Mishat Shaiti Tuva. They fly much longer distances. Karsayu b'chamishim amamalyo. Within 50 amot, they fill their bellies. Meaning that within 50 amot, they can pick off the grains off the ground and find sufficient food by that time that they won't be hungry. So even if they travel longer distances, if you give them a space of 50 amot between the point where you have the dove coat and the city, they'll be full by the time they get to the city, and they're not going to use the food of the city or of the individuals planting in the city in order to feed. Mar says, Mishat Shloshim Ris Vitulo, they only fly 30 ris and no more. Vahatanyo, Don't have a brighta. Be yishuv. Afilo meyamil lo yifros. When you're in the yishuv, you can't put up a dove trap, even within 100 mil. So now it sounds like there that they can fly much longer distances than when it's associated with the yishuv. So if Yosef Amar b'yishuv kramim, we're speaking about yishuv here, we're not talking about settlements, but we're talking about yishuv kramim, meaning that they are vineyards that are adjacent to each other. The birds will hop from vineyard to vineyard. Rabba Amar b'yishuv shovchim, that if you have dovecotes along the way, then those dovecotes along the way will allow the birds to hop from one to the next. Meaning that if you have them within this distance, well, of 30 ris, or it seems like probably a little less than that amount, then you would have the birds be comfortable, keep on flying. They'll jump from one to the next, and therefore they'll cover much larger distances, even though technically their maximum distance of flight generally is 30 ris. That's only if they don't find another vineyard, if they don't find another shovach. But if they do find them, then they'll continue hopping from one to the next. Now the Gemara asks on Rabbo's explanation, why are we worried about the distance that the doves are flying when you say over here that they fly from dovecoat to dovecoat? Which means that if you set up a trap in any of these areas, you are actually setting up a trap near a dovecoat. That means that you're going to be taking from someone else's property because those dovecoats belong to individuals. And therefore, if it's a chain of dovecoats, then in the end, the problem is not that you're close to the city or you're going to trap other people's birds. The problem is that you're going to trap someone else's birds that belong in their shovach. So the Gemara says that's not a problem for a number of possibilities. It's a non-Jewish shovach. Now, in terms of theft, we're going to see in the Gemara upcoming in Baba Kama that Gezla Goy is asur. Stealing from a non-Jew is asur, and this would be no different. The reason that over here it's different for a Goy in Israel is because there's really no theft by the birds. Because as we said before, there's no real technical ownership of the doves because they move from place to place. So you technically don't own them. But Mishum Darche Shalom, the Chachamim instituted that people respect each other's dovecotes. And so that is what we'll call a social contract within the Jewish population or amongst the Jews. It doesn't necessarily apply to those people outside of that pact. And therefore, we're not going to have this application of Darche Shalom for the Shovchim of the non-Jews, unless, of course, their laws or the Dine de Machuta would have included something like that. But if it doesn't, then there's no reason, there's no problem of quote-unquote Gezel over here, because even for a Jew, there's no Gezel. It just happens to be the Chachamim or Gozer, but they only Gozer regards to those birds or those dovecotes of Jews. The other possibility is Ipayimah Be'edah Hefker. The dovecotes are not owned by anybody, they're just areas where the birds happen to nest, or they found places where they can nest, and therefore it's like a shovach, like a dovecot, because they can move from there to the next one, and therefore that is out of hefker, and it won't be a problem in terms of trapping them. The last possibility is it's his own dovecotes that are there. So therefore he's not stealing from the dovecotes because they belong to him. The problem with his dovecotes is that those dovecotes allow the birds to fly much longer distances, and therefore he's going to have to be worried about putting up his traps around there. Because even though they're coming from his dovecotes, but the fact that there's a chain of dovecotes all the way back to, let's say, the city, that means that the birds of the city could easily come out here and then be trapped by him because they have an ability through the chain of nests or dovecotes to get out there, and there would be a reasonable amount of flight for them. And so because of that, you have to be careful. You can't set up your traps within 30 ris of those areas, or after the last one, you can't set up within 30 reeds because of the problem of the fact that they can make it as long as there's a chain of either a kramim or shovachim, they will make it much longer distances. Over here, Tosfo tries to deal with what the hava mean of the Gemara is when it says, v'yishuv afilu me'amil lo yifros. In the yishuv, you can't put it out for at least even 100 mil, which makes it sound like it would never be. You couldn't put it within the range of a yishuv forever. Now, in the end, the Gemara answers that's Yishuv Kramim and Yishuv Shovchim. But what was the Gemara's Hava mean? What type of Yishuv were they thinking about? Tosafot here suggest that maybe it was Yishuv Zraim. It was a Yishuv where there was feet or there were kernels that were on the ground or in those areas going out. And that's the Yishuv that it's speaking about, or that's what the Gemara thinks in the Hava mean. And then in the end, it says, no, that's not the case. It switches to Yishuv Kramim and Yishuv Shovach. The other possibility is that the Gemara over here, when it's speaking about Yishuv, is speaking about the equivalent of what we saw by Tchum and Eruvin. By Tchum and Eruvin, we say that a city is considered to be like Dalet Amot. And maybe that's what the Gemara is saying over here, that is, Bafilu B'Yishuv. When you're in an area of habitation, if you're in an area where people have settled, those areas are considered all to be one single area. No matter how great they are or how distant they spread out, all of that is considered to be one area, and the doves will fly freely in these habitated areas, in these settled areas. And therefore, the issue of it doesn't matter if it's a few mammal, no matter how big it is, it's all considered to be one area. And that means that their flight is much greater than you would have thought. Okay, with that, we end the Perek Hadronalach, Perek Meruba. All right, now we begin the Perek HaChovel. Now, Perek HaChovel is a shift in the Gemara. In Baba Kama, as we noted in the introduction to Baba Kama deals with, in the first part of Baba Kama, nezek that is done by your property, by your ownership to other people or other items. And that was what we dealt with in the first six prakim. The latter prakim of Masechet Baba Kama deal with two areas. One is Gneva and Gzela, and the other one is Chovel u'Mazik. We already dealt with in Perek Meruba the dinim of Gneva. In the prakim after Perek Shmini, the 9th and 10th Perek, we're going to deal with Gzela. Perek Shmini deals with what's called the Chovel. This is when a person themselves causes injury to, whether it's property or other individuals. Now, with regards to Chovel u'Mazik, it's different than, we'll say, the damaging by your money or your possessions, your property of other individuals. Over there, we discussed in the introduction to the Masechta that it wasn't clear whether there is an Isur associated with that. And if there was an Isur, what was that Isur? When it comes to Chovel u'Mazik, it's almost unequivocal that everyone believes that there is an Isur over here. That when you injure your fellow Jew or you injure their property and you're an Adama Mazik, over there, it seems very clear that you violate both Ben Adam LeChavero, but you also violate the Ben Adam LeMakom, that there's an Isur, Mina Torah, whether it's an Aseh or Lot Aseh, that you're violating when you damage another party. And then, in terms of reparations, we're going to see here in the Mishnah in 1 second that the payment or the restitution that is made is monetary restitution, which seems very similar to what we dealt with in all the first prakim of the Masechta, that when you do damage, you've got to pay for it, you've got to make up that and make restitution for it, compensate for it, and you pay money. But what is different over here by Chovel u'Mazik is the way that the Torah expresses that compensation. And in expressing that compensation, it also indicates to you both the nature that there is an Isur involved in it, as well as how you should view this compensation. And they will see this even actually as part of the Gemara, maybe even a Havamin in the Gemara, that it might have been this way. But the main psukim that deal with this part are found in Parshat Mishpatim, and the other part are found in Vayikra Perek Chavdal, which is the end of Parshat Emor. In both of those places, it says, Ayin tachat ayin, shein tachat shein, yad tachat yad, regel tachat regel. In Vayikra, it says, shever tachat shever, ayin tachat ayin, shein tachat shein, kasheiten mum ba'adam, ken yinatein bo. So over there, in all those cases, if you took this at face value, then the punishment for an individual that damages another party would be for the same thing to be done to them. If they knocked out or cut off someone's arm, then you would do the same to them. They would lose their arm. Person knocked out the other individual's eye, you'd have to take out the person who did the damage's eye. That's what it sounds like from the basic reading, the cursory reading of the psukim. Both from the nature of the psukim as well as the Drashot Chazal, it's clear that Chazal believed that that was not the case. Unlike some of the codes at the time that did demand that, it's clear here that the Torah says that that's not the way to do it. Why that is, we'll start to see it at the end of today's daf and into tomorrow's daf, and we can discuss it further. But the Gemara believes that the compensation here is monetary compensation and not the giving up of a limb. But Reb Chaim notes that the fact that the Torah expresses this in this manner tells you how you have to look at this compensation. It's somewhat akin to bringing a korban. At the beginning of Sefer Vayikra, when you bring a korban, you have view a korban, the Ramban over there, Ala Torah, tells when you bring the korban, you have to look at it as if you're on the Mizbeach, as if it's you that's there. And it's only because Yud Kei Vav Kei, the Shem Hashem of Rachamim, that allows you to get away without being put on the Mizbeach, and rather that the animal goes in your stead on the Mizbeach. And similarly, over here, you would have to look at this as found in Sefer Vayikra as well, in Parshat Emor. The same idea would be true here, which is that the ayin tachat ayin, the shein tachat shein, yes, in the end, it's made to be compensation. You make monetary restitution, but nevertheless, you have to look at it as if you're supposed to lose an arm. You're supposed to lose whatever damage you did to your friend. And that the compensation is the Torah's rachamim, letting you off by paying back that amount, but you really have to view the severity and the damage that you did as being as if you deserve to lose your arm or deserve to lose your tooth or your eye, whatever it is that is, the damage was done to. That's very important in terms of philosophically how we look at this type of behavior. And of course, if you look at it in that way, there's no question that, number one, you can't just do it, damage someone and then pay for it after the fact, because there's clearly an Iser involved and the severity is made clear by the way the Torah formulates the punishment or the repayment that needs to be made over here. In addition, if you look carefully in the Psukim in Vayikra, Chavdalet, and Pashat Emor, we're going to darshan them in today's daf, but it's important to, first of all, have them in front of you so you can see or understand today's daf, but also to note that the way that they are formulated is structured as a chiastic structure there, which means that it goes A, B, C, B, A. So that means that the bookends are the same, and as you move in, it's all the same, and they center on one thing in the middle. So if you look at the psukim over there, starting in Pasuk Tet Zayin, that's the end. It's right after the Mikalel. It's actually in the middle of the story of the Mikalel. The placement of them there is very difficult. We're not going to deal with it today, but something that needs to be discussed. But there it says, Nokev Shem Hashem Otumatra Gomir Gemu Bo Kol Eida Kager Kazrech Kenbinakvo Shem Yumat. So you see the term Kager Gezrach? Just remember that as we move through. Then the Pasuk in Yudzayin says, Ish Ki Yakeh Kol Nefesh Adam Motumat. That's an individual hitting, injuring, maybe even killing another person, Motumat. Makeh Nefesh Behema Yishalemena Nefesh Tachat Nefesh. Person who kills, seemingly, or damages the Behema, he will have to replace or make payment for that. When a person damages another party, as he has done, should be done to him. Then it says, and this is the center of that chiastic structure, shever tachat shever, ayin tachat ayin, shein tachat shein. That's the center. Then, that's very similar to the pasuk we had just before, which is, kitein mum ba'amito, kashe yase, ken yase lo. Then the next pasuk is makeh behema yishalmenu, umakeh adam yumat. Again, makeh behema, makeh adam. We're doing the same sukkim that we saw before, and the final pasuk is mishpat achar yedachem kager kaezrach. Yeh ken yashem elkechem. Again, it ends with kager kaezrach. You see here a chiastic structure. Generally, when you have a chiastic structure, the center of the structure is the most important element. And the center of the structure here is shever tachat shever, ayin tachat ayin, shein tachat shein. This is the sources for what we're going to see in our Mishnah for the payment of the Chamishat Dvarim. This is three out of the five things that you pay bechovel. And therefore, that's the center of the structure. What's the meaning of that in the center of the structure? Well, what Reb Chaim explained would make a lot of sense and would help us to understand it a lot. I also note that there are mefarshim that want to indicate that the psukim say two different things. One says, kasher asa ken yaselo, like he did should be done to him. And then the other pasuk says, kasher yiten mum ba'adam ken yinatein bo. So again, it's repeated. Again, they're using different words. Seemingly, it's the same pasuk, and that's the pashtut here. But the Gemara will say, ken yinatein is davar shenitan, things that are given. Things that are given is considered to be money or metaltalim. And therefore, the Gemara sees one pasuk as speaking, kesher yiten mum ba'adam ken yinatein bo, is the monetary compensation. If you do that, then maybe the repetition of the psukim are telling you that even though monetary compensation is the way that you deal with the shever tachat shever, ayin tachat ayin, and shein tachat shein, nevertheless, the lead-in pasuk, which is kesher asa ken yaselo, is really what should really happen over here. And so therefore, embedded in these psukim is actually the idea that both the monetary compensation, that is what you do in the end, should not be looked simply as monetary compensation, but rather, kasher asa ken yaselo, as he did, should be done to him, and that's the way he should view this damage that he did to the other party. Interesting to note, my Rebbe Rosenzweig points out that in the Rambam, when he puts together the prakim, or he orders out the halachot of nizakim, meaning in Seder Nizakin, in the Mishnah Torah, when he puts the halachot of Niske Mamon, and then at the end, he has Hilchot Chovel Mazik, and then Hilchot Rotzeach. So he juxtaposes or puts together Chovel Mazik with Rotzeach, not together with Niske Mamon. And so he pointed out, he thinks that the Rambam intentionally ordered it that way in order to indicate that Chovel Mazik looks a lot more like Rotzeach than it does like Niske Mamon. And so therefore you have to look at, in many ways, and that's the way the Psukim we're going to see today, formulate the type of nezek, which is that a person who does this damage, motumat, he's going to die. And therefore, that someone who damages or injures other parties is doing like a mini killing of that individual. The way Rashi formulates it today is that he's killed that Aver. He's destroyed or killed that Aver. It's the equivalent of killing on a smaller scale. But because of that, maybe that's why the Rambam also puts Chovel Mazik right next to the Halachot of Rotzeach. All right, with that introduction, we're going to begin now Perek HaChovel. Here it begins. Chovel b'chaveiro, someone who injures or damages his friend, chayelav avlav mishum chamisha dvarim, is required to make compensation for five things. So those five things are learnt out of the Psukim. We'll read what those five things are, and then Rashi tells us where they come from. Benezek, for the damage, Bitzar for the pain, Ripui is the medical bills, Shevet is the unemployment, and Boshet is the embarrassment. And Rashi notes over here that these five dvarim come out of the Psukim. Nezek comes out of Ayin Tachat Ayin, Tzar comes out of Petza Tachat Petza, and then Ripui and Shevet come out of the Psukim and Gedim Mishpatim, Rab Shifto Yiten, Rapo Yirapeh, and Boshet comes out of the Psukim in Parshat Kitetze, Vakatzotat Kapah, but Mamon, these are the things actually we saw earlier in the Masechta. So those are the sources for the different items that are mentioned here. Now the Mishnah is going to describe to us how you assess each one of these items. Benezek Ketzad. How do we assess the damage that is done here? Sima et eno. If a person blinded the individual, kata et yado, or he cut off his arm, shiber et raglo, or broke his leg. Remember in those days, if their leg was broken, that was a permanent situation, and that person would have difficulty walking or being mobile for the rest of their lives because there was no way to set the bones and have them heal. Roino tokiluhu evet nimkar bashuk. Actually, the other day was a little easier to assess this type of damage because you want to really know not only what the damage is, but the present value of that damage. Well, if you have an active slave market, it's very easy to know what the damage that is done here because the sale of a slave is basically the present value of what you expect this slave to be able to do on your behalf. And Rashi over here quotes that the individual themselves could have sold themselves an Eved Ivri, and therefore this is the rightful monies that should be paid to them. Although I'm not sure Rashi is literally like an Eved Ivri, just saying that's why they're entitled to compensation like this, but more likely comparison is to that of an Eved Kanani. An Eved Kanani who's sold into servitude, he is viewed as a monetary possession, and that sale involves the present value of what you think this Eved Kanani is going to be worth to you. And that will be assessed based on age, based on strength. And again, the lack of an arm or the lack of an eye would detract from the value of that slave. That detraction in value is exactly what we're looking for. That's the nezek. That's the present value of the damage that is done over the remainder of the life of this individual. And so that's exactly what you do over here. You take him to the shuk and say, how much would he sell for now? And how much he would have sold for before? Shamin, kamaya yafeb, kamahu yafeb. How much was he worth before? How much is he worth now? And that determines the nezek. That is the damage that is done here. Tsar, when it comes to pain, how do we assess that? Kiva'o b'shipud o b'masmer. He burns him with a stake or with a nail. I don't know if it means to burn him with a nail or to puncture his nail. Afilu al tziparno, even on his nail. Here the Gemara is talking about pain that does not include permanent damage. It is damage or nezek that is not a matter that is really nezek. It's simply pain that is caused here. Kom sheino aser chubara, meaning that here the Mishnah describes as a place that doesn't leave permanent damage. Omdim, we assess. Kama adam kiyotz v'zer rotze lito liot mitzter kach. How much would a person pay or be accepting payment in order to have this pain? Now, the Pashtuta Mishnah means that how much would someone accept, meaning how much could you pay them in order to undergo this pain? Rishonim and the Gemara itself indicates that that may not be the right way to do this because there are some people who will not accept any amount of money to go through that pain. So rather, they view it, or the way that they express it, is that how much would a person pay in order to avoid this pain? Meaning that if they were already Nigzala Malchut, is the way that the Rishonim say that the government has decreed upon them this punishment or this pain, how much would they pay in order to get out of this pain? And psychologically, it's clear that people will definitely pay money in order to avoid pain, and that they would maybe not accept large sums of money, or the amount of money that they would have to take to undergo pain far exceeds the amount of money that they would pay to avoid pain. And so therefore, the right way to assess it is to look at it as the avoidance of pain or the money that people would pay to avoid that pain. But here we're trying to isolate the pain from the damage that's done. The first thing is damage. The second thing is, what happens if I did it under anesthetic? Meaning that obviously that would be a much easier way to undergo this in painkillers versus what actually happened over here where the person didn't have an anesthetic and didn't have the painkillers, and so he underwent a tremendous amount of pain. That pain is independent. The physical pain is independent of the damage that was done. Ripui, the doctor bills, medical bills, is higau chayav l'rapoto. You're chayav to ensure that he gets the right medical attention and then is cured. Alavo tzmachim, if there is growth that appears on the wound. Over here, it's not clear if that means that there's an infection that is growing there or that the scabbing isn't happening properly and the wound is not healing properly. But for whatever reason, there's growth or problems with the healing process. Imach mata makah chayav. If it's because of the blow or the original wound, then you are responsible to ensure that it gets cured. Shlomach mata makah patur. If it's not connected directly to the original wound or damage that was done, then you're not responsible. Chayta v'nistara. If it got better and then deteriorated. Chayta v'nistara. Got better and deteriorated. Chayav. Rapoto, in all those cases, he is responsible to medically treat the individual. Chayta kol tzorcha, if it's fully remedied, it was fully cured, then enu chayav rapoto, then he's off the hook. Anything that happens after that point is not connected to the original wound, and therefore he does not have to deal with the medical ramifications of it. Shevet is the unemployment. Wemoto kiilu shomer kishuim, as if he is guarding zucchinis, gourds, or cucumbers. Shvarnatano dmei yado dmei raglo. So the Mishnah points out, in the present value calculation of the Nezek, you already paid him for the loss of work that he can do. Maybe that an Eved without a leg or an Eved without an arm sells for much less at the auction than an Eved with those limbs because of the nature of work that an Eved can do with those limbs versus an Eved without those limbs. So in terms of the degrading of his ability to work, that was already captured in the present value calculation of the Nezek. But even in this state, he still has the ability to work on much lighter items, but he's stuck in a hospital bed because of what you did. Therefore, you have to pay for the unemployment during the time that he is unable to work at all. You have to pay for the unemployment, not just the Nezek, which took down his employability, but also for the fact that he could be employed at this lower level, and he can't do that now because he's sitting in a hospital. Boshet, when it comes to embarrassment, to call the fiyam mitvayesh, va-mitvayesh. Over here, it's very subjective. It all has to do with the one who caused the embarrassment, as well as the one who is embarrassed. So, over here, Rashi claims that the lower the stature of the individual that causes the embarrassment, the more the embarrassment is. And the higher the level of the individual who is embarrassed, then the greater the embarrassment. There are Rishonim, and you could think about this logically, that it might be just the opposite. That the higher the stature of the individual that causes the embarrassment, the more embarrassing it is because of the stature of the individual and the implications of someone of that stature causing the embarrassment. So you could argue the other way around, but it's clear here with regards to busha, which is the psychological damage caused by the damage that's done here or the nezek that's done here, that is very subjective, both situational and people involved in the circumstances. So it's both personal and subjective to context, how you would pay the busha. The owner of the item that seemingly is the same as this is maybe tsar. The way that the Mishnah formulated tsar, it seems like that is also a subjective manner because it's a question of how much person would accept either to go undergo that pain or to avoid that pain. How much would they pay? So that is a subjective nature. So those two items, which seem to be the side effects, which are the physical side effects and the psychological side effects of the damage that's done here, both of those seem to be more subjective in their nature in the method of calculation. Now, the Gemara wants to know, Amai, why is this the case? Why are you paying Chamisha Dvarim? Why are you making restitution in these situations? Where it says, Ayin Tachet Ayin Amai Rachmana. The Pasuk says that you pay an eye for an eye. Ayma Ayin Mamash. Why don't you say literally an eye? Why are you convinced, or why is the Mishnah saying that it's a monetary compensation? Why don't we say that it's literally an eye? It says, Lo saka datcho. You wouldn't think this. The Tanya, Yocho simat eino, misamet eino. You would think a person who blinds another individual, you would blind them. Katayat yado, or if he cut off someone else's arm. Mekatayat yado, you would cut off his arm. Shiberet raglo, if he broke someone else's leg. Meshiberet raglo, in return, you would break his leg. Tamalomar, make adam, umake beima. That there is a gzeres shava between damaging an individual and damaging an animal. It's clear that when you damage an animal, that you're making restitution, compensation, paying for the damage that's done. The worst hit that you can do to an animal is to kill the animal. Even if you kill the animal fully, we're still not going to kill the individual who perpetrated that crime and put them to death for killing the animal. We are going to find them. We are going to make them make restitution for the killing of the animal. So it's clear there that the makeh behema is tashlumim, af makeh adam l'tashlumim. So too, when it comes to damage that is wrought by an individual on another person, that also is subject to tashlumim payment and not corporal or a quid pro quo punishment. Vim nafshach lomar harei omer. If you want to say that that doesn't work, now here the Braita doesn't tell you what it is, im nafshach lomar, what you wanted to say. If you want to say this, then I have this pasuk to back me up. So the Braita leaves out what the havamina might have been to reject the previous limud, but then offers you an alternative limud, and then the Gemara itself will dissect that, which is lo tichu kofer le nefesh rutzeach, asher hu rasha lamut. So over here it says that you may not accept the payment of kofer, you may not accept, we'll call it, a bribe, or a payment in lieu of putting someone to death. If it's a murderer and he's supposed to get the death penalty, accepting monetary compensation to let him off the hook is unacceptable. Kofar, in that case, paying the money does not work. The Gemara is mitayek from that. Nefesh rotzeach yata lokeach kofar. For someone who killed, you may not accept kofar. Aval ata lokeach kofar lo reshei avarim she'enon chodrin. You may accept kofar for the 24 limbs, where these are the major limbs that if they are damaged, are permanently damaged and do not return. Those you can accept kofar or quote unquote bribery for, which is those can be paid off and you don't actually injure the party that perpetrated the crime. You don't do that back to them, but rather accept monetary compensation. Now the Gemara wants to know, hey makeh, which word makeh or makah are you looking at in the psukim that tells you this din? Ilema, if you want to say it's the pasuk in Vayikra Perchav Dalet, pasuk Chav Aleph, which is makeh beima yishalmena, umakeh adam yumat. So over there you have the juxtaposition of the makeh beima to the makeh adam. Gemara says over there, how ubiktalaktiv. That's talking about death. Now, it's not clear how the Gemara knows it's talking about death over there. It says makeh adam yumat. If you kill someone, then you die. So seemingly there, they're taking the word yumat very literally. And therefore, makeh adam yumat is put to death. So it seems there we're talking about killing and not damaging. Now that might come out of one of two possibilities: is that makeh behema yishalmena, yishalmena over there makes it sound like you have to make a full payment for the animal, which means that you killed the animal. So if that's the case, then the makeh adam is also killing adam. Or in contrast to the other pasuk, which says ish kiyakeh kol nefesh adam. Over there, they're both a darsh and kol nefesh adam means any part of the adam. And so over here, where it just says makeh adam, it sounds like the whole adam was hit or killed over here. Therefore, the pasuk chafal of the Gemara says is clearly talking about killing, whether it's killing the animal or killing an adam. And therefore, that can't be the solution to our problem over here, because that's not talking about the case of chovel. So that can't be the source. Elamiocha, it must be the psukim in the beginning. Remember, we're going to quote psukim that almost sound exactly the same because of the structure in Vayikra Chavdal, which is a chiastic structure, which means that psukim that are found later are also found earlier. And this is from pasuk Yudchet, makeh nefesh beima yishalmena, nefesh tachat nefesh. So over there, the Gemara says, that's the source. V'samichle, and juxtaposed, adjacent to that, the pasuk right after that is, in pasuk Yudchet, is ish ki tein mum bamito, kasher asa ken yaselo. That whatever you did to your fellow Jew, that is what you have to do to him. Now, the Gemara here uses the term samichle, which is juxtaposed, which makes it sound like the limud is a limud of smuchim. It's a limud that comes out of the adjacency of the psukim. The problem with that, and you can see Tosfot raises this issue, is that we're not talking about smichut over here. We're talking about gzer shava of hakah hakah, and the next line of the Gemara will bear that out. So what does the smichut have anything to do with hakah hakah? Balei Tosfot suggests that maybe that's the reason. The reason to favor the gzeres shava over here. There are many times the word makeh is used here in the psukim. Why are we favoring Pasuk Yutet over the other Pesukim? It's because it's adjacent, because it's right next to it. And therefore, we're favoring the Gzera Sheva of the two adjacent Pesukim. That's the way Tosafot deals with it. He does bring a possibility of eliminating it from the Girsa, and other Rishonim say the same thing, just to eliminate it from the Girsa. The word Samich just doesn't belong over here, and that's the improper way to express it, because we're going to make Gzera Sheva, not Samich. The other possibility is to explain, and we're going to see in 1 second, that in the second Pasuk here, the word Makeh does not appear. And therefore, you need, in order to make this a Gzera Sheva, you need both an implicit word Makeh there, but also the adjacency of the Pesukim helps you to make that Gzera Sheva, even though the word itself is not found there. So maybe that might be another way to solve the problem, which is the Gemara asks over here, Hai Lav Makehu. That Pasuk, V'kitein Mum Ba'amitok Asher Asah Ken Yaselo, does not contain the word Makeh in it. Gemara says, Haka'ah, Haka'ah Kamrinan. No, that what we're saying over here is Haka'ah, Haka'ah. The way Rashi explains it is this is like Tana Debei Rabbi Shmuel, who says that when it comes to Gzera Sheva, we're not always looking for the exact same word. We're looking for two items that mean generally the same thing, even though the words are different. So over here, Kitein Mumba Mito is the same thing as a Haka, as a Makeh, as hitting. So too, that's what makes Gzera Sheva Makeh Makeh, even though the word Haka does not appear explicitly in the Pasuk. So now the Gemara says, Ma Haka Marua Bebeima L'Tashlumim. Just like the hakah that's mentioned by the Beima is compensation. Afakah mura ba'adam l'tashlumim. So too, the hakah by the Adam means compensation and not the injury of the individual. Vaktiv. Isn't the pasuk there before say, v'ish k'yakeh kol nefesh adam mot yumat? That the pasuk before in Yud Zayin says that a person who hits another individual, mot yumat, she'll be killed. Now, some Rishonim don't like this part of the Gemara because that's talking about mita. That's talking about killing. And killing has nothing to do with our Gemara. We're talking about Nezek over here. Rashi interprets it in a way that makes that plausible, which he says that the ish ki yakeh kol nefesh adam motumat, that the yakeh that is a mita over here is the killing of the Aver. And so the killing of the Aver, motumat, motumat means that you would kill back the Aver of the individual. That's what it sounds like from the Pasuk. My answer is that's not the case, b'mamon. That's talking about monetary compensation. Mimai de mamon. Why do you think it's talking about monetary compensation? Ema b'mita mamash. Why don't you say it literally means to kill? Again, literally to kill would not be to put the person to death, and that's why some of the Rishonim don't like this section of the Gemara and eliminate it. Again, Rashi says to kill doesn't mean to literally kill, but to take out the aver, kill that aver. Lo sakadatcho, that we would not think. Chado, daid kish to makeh beima. First reason we wouldn't think this is because it's a hekesh between Adam and Behema. And just like by Behema, it is Tashlumim. So to over here, by Adam, it'll be Tashlumim. That's because of the hekesh, the makeh Behem Yishomena. V'od k'tiv batre. It says afterwards, kasher yitin mum ba'adam, keini natein bo. So again, that's the second time that's in this structure. We brought down the first pasuk, which is, ish k'tiv mum ba'amitok asher asa ken yaselo. Then it says, shever tachat shever, ayin tachat ayin, shen tachat shen. And then, kasher yitin mum ba'adam, keini natein bo. Shma mima, mamon. From that, you would see that it's mamon. The repetition of the psukim. Now, whether it's simply the repetition itself indicates that it's mamon, otherwise, why is it necessary? Or is it the fact that it says, keini natein, that you will give something? That giving is implies that it's melitaltalim, which the Gemara Darshan's in other places, that generally something that goes miyad liyad is mamon or metaltalim. Those are valuables that are passed from one hand to the other, or in essence, payment. So now the Gemara goes back and says about the Braita, Mayim Nafshach Halomar. So now that you have this limud of Haka Haka, which tells you that just like by Hema there's monetary compensation, so too by Adam is monetary compensation, then why do you have to bring another pasuk? We have a good source now. So somebody says, Tu Kakash, the Tana, that the Tana still has a problem with this limud. May chazit yofot mi makah beima, leilif mi makah Adam. Why are you learning this out from Makeh Beima? Learning it out from Makeh Adam. And by Makeh Adam, there it says Motumat. So why don't we let that establish the principle rather than the Makeh Behema establish the principle of compensation? So Amri, Danim Nizakim and Nizakim and Danim Nizakim and Mita. That's because we want to parallel Nezek and Nezek. That's Adam Chovel and Adam Chovel Behema. Those two are alike. To compare the Nezek of an Adam to Adam to a killing of an Adam, those two are not considered to be of a similar nature enough to make it that you'd make the Gzera Sheva that way. So Gemara says, wait a minute. Adarabba, Danim Adam Adam, Vein Danim Adam Behema. It makes more sense to parallel the Dinim of Adam than to put the Adam to learn him out of a Behema. So for that reason, I know the Tanim Nafshechalomar, if that is your question about this limud, Hari Omer, I have a different pasuk then to deal with this. Lo tikhu kov for the nefesh rotzeach asher hu rasha lamot. Kimot yumat. Nefesh rotzeach yata lokeach kofer. You may not accept payment to release a murderer. But you are allowed to accept compensation for the destruction of limbs that are not replaceable. That's what we use that pasuk for. We need to learn out of that pasuk. Don't do two things, this individual. Don't both kill the murderer and take money for his kofar from him. That's unacceptable. You can't take both. Gemara says, "I'm Ichdevi Shato Nafka." Wait a minute, that's Kamle the Rabbi Mine. Then we learn out of the pasuk of Ichdevi Shato. You're allowed to punish him once, hold him culpable once. You can't hold him culpable twice for the same act. And therefore, if he's going to be put to death for the murder, he's not going to make a monetary compensation. So that we don't learn out of Lo Tikhu Kofar the Nefesh Adam. Gemara says, "Vakatami Baile." We still need that pasuk, the Kama Rachmana, the pasuk says, Lo tishko mamon v'tiftirei, for the pashtura pasuk, which is, don't accept money instead of the capital punishment that this individual deserves. He needs to be put to death and not accept money in lieu of his being put to death. That's what the pasuk's telling you, and that's the pashtura pasuk. It says, Imken lechtov Rachmana lo tichu kofer, lasher hu rasha lamut, lenefesh rotzeach lamali, so that becomes extraneous now. From that extraneous language or that unnecessary language in the pasuk, we are midayek from that you do not accept compensation for a murderer, but you will accept compensation when it comes to the destruction of other people's limbs that is irreversible. Now the Gemara says, "Michar dichtiv lo tichu kofer makeh makeh lamali." Well, once you have that pasuk, what do I need the gzer shava makeh makeh for? Amre, imi hai, if it was from the pasuk of Lo Tikhu Kofer, hava mina ibai eino neitev, ibai demei eino neitev. Then we would have given a choice. Either he loses his eye, or he makes compensation. It's not clear here to whom they make that offer. But that's an offer to the victim to decide what he wants. Does he want compensation from this individual, or does he want that individual's eye knocked out? Or it means that the person who is going to be punished, meaning the perpetrator of the crime, does he get to choose whether he wants to lose his eye or make payment? It's not clear from the Gemara what the Havamina is, that maybe there was this option to both damage the individual as well as take compensation, and they get to decide which one it is, but not preclude one of them. That's what you would learn out from Lo Tikhu Kofer. So along comes Makeh Makeh, Kamash Malan, Mi Behema, Ma Makeh Behema, the Tashlumim, Af Makeh Adam, the Tashlumim. Comes to tell you that there's only one exclusive way to deal with this, and that is compensation or restitution. That is similar to an animal that's damaged or killed. The only way to rectify the situation is to pay for the damage that was done. And similarly over here, the only way to rectify the situation is to pay for the damage that is done. There is no corporal punishment. There is no quid pro quo type of punishment that is allowed whatsoever. And that we learn out of the Gzer Shava of Makeh, Makeh, Makeh Adam from Makeh Behema. Right now, Tanya Rabbi Dustai. Here the Gemara is going to begin to learn or prove or try to prove the fact that we are talking about mamon in all these cases and not literally ayin tachat ayin and shein tachat shein. So here the Gemara is make a first attempt to a brayta and reject it, which is Tanya the Rabbi Dustai ben Yerumer, ayin tachat ayin mamon. Says ayin tachat ayin, it means monetary compensation. Ata omer mamon ayin ola ayin mamash. You're saying it's monetary compensation. Maybe it's a real eye that he has to lose. Amart, aresha itai no shel zek gdola veino shel zek tana. If one guy has a big eye and the other one has a small eye, then it's not really an eye for an eye, because he damaged a small eye, and now you're going to take out his eye, which is a big eye. So you want to say, in cases where it's uneven, in cases where we can't take out the same size eye, because the perpetrator of the crime has a different size eye than the victim, maybe there we will allow for monetary compensation. But in any other case, we will do literally an eye for an eye. So Amra Mishpat Achad Yelachem. The Torah says over here that there should be a Mishpat Achad Yelachem Kager Kazrach Yek Yani Hashem Lekachem. We have to have consistent punishments. Mishpat Ashaveh Lekuchem. There's only one type of punishment, and the punishment has to be consistent amongst all. So therefore, if there are cases where the punishment can't be Ayin Tachar Ayin, and it is monetary compensation, then that applies to everyone. It applies across the board, and monetary compensation is the only way you can solve the problem. Amre, my kushya, why is this a problem at all? This isn't a proof that you have to use mamon. Dilma nehora shakilmine, nehora amarachmana nishkomine. So wait, what this person caused is not about a physical size of the eye. What this individual did was took away the eyesight of the victim. And so what the Torah says is, you take away the eyesight of the victim, then we're going to take away your eyesight. And that's the quid pro quo. That's the punishment over here. And then you're not dealing with an unevenness in any way, because it doesn't matter how big the eye is or small the eye is. It's not about size. It's about functionality. And if you took away that function from another individual, then maybe the Torah is saying, take away that function from that person who caused that problem. So I'm not sure. The Gemara over here leaves this, but I would say that you could have the same problem even within eyesight. I mean, you could have someone who has very poor vision and poor eyesight, and another person has excellent eyesight, or someone who's almost blind, and someone who has perfect vision. So then if the person causes, the person has almost deteriorated eyesight already, causes them to go blind, that's very different than then going and punishing the individual to lose his eyesight completely. Gemara sees this as binary. Either you have eyesight or you don't have eyesight. It doesn't see it in gradations. But I could see you arguing the same logic with regards to eyesight. The Gemara doesn't bring that with regards to this braita, but I understand I could see that problem here as well. And the Gemara says, right, so if you don't explain it this way, katan sharaget agadol, if you have a, now normally you would say katan means a youngster, that's not the way to interpret it over here, it's Rashi notes over here, katan means a smaller individual kills a bigger individual. Begadol sharaget katan, or a larger individual kills a smaller individual. How can you put them to death? But Torah amra mishpat echad yalechem, that you have to have one mishpat, mishpat hashevelu kulchem, everybody has to be even. So what? If he kills a smaller person, then killing the bigger person, that's an unevenness in the killing. Ela, nishama shakil mine, nishama amar rachmana nishko mine. It's clear that what the Torah is after is that you took away the life of an individual, therefore you will lose your life because of that. Meaning that the punishment is not about the size of the individual, it's simply about the cause of loss of life. You caused loss of life, therefore the punishment of the individual causes loss of life is the loss of their life. And that's always equal. Life is equal. Life force, or the ability to live, is equal amongst people. And that equation is fair. So Achanami, so to over here, Nahora Shakomine, Nahora Machmana Nishkomine. So therefore, over here, when we talk about the Ayin Tachan Ayin, you can't prove from this that it's Mamon, because you could have argued that it has to do with eyesight. You took away the eyesight of one individual, that means that that individual deserves to lose their eyesight, and that's equal, of equal nature. Now, in comparing it to death, it's interesting here because of the way that we look at life. I mean, at least the Jewish view or philosophy of life is that et chayisha, that even a momentary life is worth it, is like chayolam, is worth the eternity of life. And we look at every moment of life as being precious in that way. Because you could argue that even within life, that there is a difference between if a person or an individual kills someone who is teetering on death versus killing someone in the prime of their life. So obviously the Torah does not differentiate, meaning that life is life, and no matter what, you take it away. And that might be what's pushing the Gemara towards the saying the same thing with eyesight. Even though, I think you could argue that they're different, but saying that eyesight is either binary. It's either you have it or you don't have it. Same way that life, you're either alive or you're not alive. Doesn't matter. We're not looking at the qualitative nature of that life. That's not important. And so to over here, by the eyesight, we're not looking at the qualitative nature of the eyesight. We're just looking at the fact that there is or there isn't eyesight. But by this, the Gemara rejects the first proof to show you that this pasuk here, or the psukim and mishpatim or emor, which says ayin tachat ayin, is speaking about mamon. Maybe that's not the case. We have a way to explain it that will not upset the logic surrounding it, and that you could argue that it's talking about eyesight and not mamon. And so again, here we don't have a proof yet to the fact that this is speaking about mamon and not literally taking away the eyesight of the other individual. Okay, we're going to stop here by the two dots on the top of Pei Daled Amud Aleph.